Good morning. I think we ought to get started. And I want to make a few introductory remarks. So while that's going on, Sarah's going to pass out a little survey. I'm going to ask you guys to... There's a question about Omnivore's Dilemma that I want to ask you. So during the period this morning, if you would just scratch out your opinion, or if you don't have an opinion, you can say to heck with it, you know. But I would like to kind of like to do the little survey. It's mindless. And then there'll be a couple of boxes at the exits when you guys leave at the end this morning. Just throw them in there. No signatures, no nothing, you know, just an opinion survey. Okay? It's for my, just for my curiosity. Now, a question has come up about, well, are we going to be tested on what's in Omnivore's Dilemma? And the answer is, yes, kind of. Just like every other bit of reading in the class, I will not go to the book and look for questions. Only things that are discussed here in our lecture period or are posted on the website, you know, are kind of an amplification of that written on the website. Those are the only things that you're responsible for. So, in principle, it's possible not even to read the darn thing. I'm not going to be looking over your shoulders. I recommend it. I think it's a good read, and it's an easy read. And, you know, you're in charge of your own time, how you do that. You can certainly deal with the material from what we talk about here in lecture and what on the website. There will not be any surprises. That make sense? So that'll be, you know, our last quiz is actually the last formal day of class, you know, because we have this new reading recitation review week after that. You all on top of that? Probably more than I am. Okay. So I have scheduled to keep this room, requested to have it during our regular 11 a.m. to 12 noon period during our week. And I will be here at that time. So there will not be any new material. But we'll do reading, review, and recitation. In other words, it'll be a review period. Mainly question and answer during those regular times. Okay. Whether I'll schedule any other review periods in addition to that will kind of depend on demand, whether we do it during the week or not. I would think a couple hours would probably be enough. So you'll get your current quiz back, which I think so far, the grading's not done, but people are doing very well. So you'll get those back on Thursday at discussion section. Then the last week of formal classes, that's like next week, on that Wednesday we will have quiz 5. And we'll get those results back to you as soon as we can, maybe even during the final. We're not going to have a final that's going to take all 3 hours. No. It's worth 75 points, so that's like 3 quizzes worth. So figure 3 times 20 minutes should take an hour. Some of you would take an hour and a half. I doubt if it'll take much longer than that. It's very difficult to be really precise about those things. I still haven't mastered that, but it's not going to be a 3-hour exam. Okay. Are there any questions about any of this stuff? What's expected from Omnivore's Dilemma? Yeah.
What type of form is going to be?
Well, it's going to be similar to, but not identical. I'm thinking about it. I'll talk more about it, but I'll tell you what's on my mind right now. Is about half of it to be what I call regurgitation type questions. Maybe pick words from the word lists of all the lectures, 26, 27, 28, whatever they are. Look at those word lists and Pick a dozen and you got to answer 10 of them. Define or explain. Okay. Something. It'll cover the whole course. And I'm thinking of, for the other half of the points, something like giving you some problems that are very close to things that we've talked about in the class, but will not be identical. In other words, you'll have to apply, you know, something about the, something I say about the immune system. Instead of asking you how does the immune system work, I may say, you know, there's such and such a disease at such and such a time. What do you expect the response to be? What would be your recommendations? I may have you write just a little bit longer, not anything real lengthy, but the idea is to see whether you're getting the big ideas and whether you have an understanding of them rather than a lot of trivia. That's the best I can do right now because I haven't written the exam. And I've looked over the old ones and they kind of seem, I'm not too interested in them. So, I don't know. Sometimes we fall back on that, you know, because creativity has been known to lag. So, any other questions? We can talk more about the exam stuff. I'm happy to do that when we get closer and I get something figured out. Okay. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about Omnivore's Dilemma. Help me out by telling me a little bit, giving me an answer to that survey question, which may seem trivial, but will be useful to me. Okay. And we may even start talking about it today. See how far we get. I'm going to post in the lecture notes some questions used on on a previous Quiz 5 exam. I don't know whether it's from 2006 or 2008, but some previous questions. Matter of fact, we're just going to take a look at one right now, just kind of to get you sharpened up. But I'll be posting those on the lecture notes on BSpace, so give you a feeling for what's been done in the past. So that by review, that's what I. Let's take a look at that. Okay, so this first part is a question asked on Quiz 5 straight out of the lecture material, saying what three factors in addition to birth rate B contribute to the number of persons in a population? And I on the quiz, I didn't give any answers. So these are just things for us to talk about here. So what three things besides B contribute to growth rate? Literacy? What do you think?
No.
No? Anybody want to vote yes? Yeah, well, I think you could argue that literacy, you know, one of the things we discuss is that literacy in a population, especially females, is correlated with a lower birth rate, and so it could be a contributing factor. But we've already had B there, so yeah, so I guess it's definitely no. How about cardiovascular disease? Would that be a contributing factor? Yeah. In what respect? What would it influence? Death rate. So death rate's the big one, and that would contribute to death rate. So how you would if somebody gave that answer, cardiovascular disease, what three factors? They need to explain that a little bit in order to get full credit for that. Yeah, cardiovascular disease, you could consider that because that influences the death rate, and the death rate is the biggie. How about soil fertility? Yeah. That would contribute to what? I'd say maybe birth rate, maybe death rate, overall health. something like that? You'd have to, you know, you'd have to explain those answers a little bit. If you just put down death rate, immigration, and migration in addition to birth rate, that would be the regurgitation correct answer. You would have memorized it correctly. But you could put these other things and explain them, and I would know that you're understanding what's going on, which is what we're trying to assess. Okay. So high-speed rail, well, that could affect immigration or migration. I guess migrate to LA or whatever. Okay, that's just to get you thinking. So that was a very simple regurgitation type question on the fifth quiz the last time this material was covered. In 2008, the last time this course was taught, we didn't talk about these issues at all. We talked about something else. Okay, well, I want to pick up where we left off last time, which was looking at the measurement of growth rates and looking at this curve, the so-called logistic curve, which the first part of it is kind of exponential growth that we've talked about, and that would go on without limit. But when we consider that there might be limits on resources, which is K, that's the mathematical symbol used for it, becomes to be an S-shaped curve. That's frequently encountered in biology. As a matter of fact, that was the origin of this comes from microbiology. If you take some bacteria, a couple of bacteria, and put them in a flask, nutrient broth, and you start growing them, and you measure the growth rate of a population of bacteria. Now, that's in a closed, defined environment with a set amount of nutrients in it. That is the kind of growth rate you get. If this was yeast, for example, what happens? Does it run out of food if you're growing yeast? Well, that could be, but if you put more food in there, you still get this. Something else becomes limiting. Anybody have a guess, just for fun, what might limit the population of growth of yeast? Oh, come on, you guys are in college. You know about alcohol. Well, smother each other is not quite right. They begin to secrete so much, it makes so much alcohol, and when you get to 14%, it's toxic. You know, lethal levels of alcohol. They fouled their own nest, if you want to put it that way. And that's why the limit for the alcohol content of wine is around 14-15%. Some occasions you'll see it up to, and they can spike it and get it higher, but the yeast can only get it up to about 14-15% alcohol, because then that kills the yeast. Whatever, there's something in the environment that's not sustainable. And you see this over and over and over again. And we're subject to those same kinds of constraints. So there's been a lot of activity in this field for decades about how to figure out what K is. I mean, you can do these math. Matter of fact, here's an example. Maybe we looked at this example before. If you say the K for the Earth, the carrying capacity of the Earth that can be sustained is these different things, you can see you can sustain different populations. They'll level off at different places. It's just arithmetic. So over the years, I've just picked a few out of some textbooks on this subject and some studies on this subject to show you how they vary. And people in this field, these tended to be tremendously influential. A guy named Penck in 1925. The method he used for figuring out K was he tried to figure out how many calories does a person need, how many people are there right now, how many more calories can we expect to grow? So it was all done kind of very mathematically and modeling-wise. And he came up with a figure of almost about 16 billion people would be the limit. And then we couldn't produce any more calories. But, you know, things have changed since 1925. And he did not consider any issues. He just looked at acreage that you could plant. He didn't look at soil quality, whether it could be maintained or not. He didn't look at changes in the environment. And so after a while, people that got more sophisticated thought, that's not very reliable. So in 1966, a guy named DeWitt said, let's measure photosynthesis, because that's where all calories, all food eventually comes from. If you didn't know that before, let me underline that. Pay attention. All calories eventually come from the process of photosynthesis. Think about what you eat. We eat animals that eat either other animals, or the animals eat plants, but eventually it's the plants that are capturing the energy from the sunlight. And the way they do that is through the process of photosynthesis. So it's at some level extraordinarily simple. If we could measure how much photosynthesis there is, how much of the sunlight coming on the earth is actually captured by green plants, we'd know a max. We'd be able to set some limits. So this is what DeWitt did, and he came up with something like 1,000 billion, and then he started fudging his figures. I didn't read the original paper, I just took somebody's word for it. He said, well, it's too crowded, and we have to subtract for this, and we have to subtract for that, and then he fudged it and came up with, well, we could support 79 billion. So a very well-known ecologist, E.O. Edward Wilson, still alive and kicking at Harvard, carried out his own estimates, doing it somewhat differently in 2002, using photosynthesis again, and he assumed that everybody was a vegetarian. None of us ate any animals at all. So that you get much more bang for the buck that way, calorie-wise, okay. Because there's a tremendous inefficiency built in. We're going to talk about that later. When you go from plant to animal to human, you lose a lot of the... It's a very inefficient transfer of energy, if you want to look at it just from that point of view. So he came up with 16 billion for K if we're all vegetarians. So, you know, all this is pretty... I mean, this is academia after all, but it is very academic and very unreliable, and most past estimates, these are only a selected few, very all over the place. And often they're influenced by people's political biases, whether they know that or not. There's a lot of how things ought to be built into these estimates, so you can fudge a lot of different ways. It's not very objective. In a way, when you think about it, it may be impossible to actually determine K. Maybe you can get some ball, maybe you can ballpark it. If you do that, the best available figures, we'll have to take water into account. Maybe we should talk about water first. You know, we're going to have to consider not just what the total resources are, because we could have plenty of water here and there's not enough in Jordan, say, for example. We're going to ship the water from here to Jordan. So there's a lot to do with costs of things. There's a lot to do with unevenness of distribution. There's a lot to do, as we talked about last time, with what is the desired quality of life. So people don't talk very much anymore about getting an absolute number for K. It's much softer than that now. How can we get our head around this problem, just as citizens or public policy people, whatever? And so what I want to talk a little bit more about this is the idea of the tragedy of the commons, or another way of putting that is looking at open access resources. So this way of looking at the problem stems from a very influential essay in 1968 by a human ecologist named Gerhard Hardin, who's at the Washington University in St. Louis. And he said, let's think about our country, our community, the world, whatever. Let's think about it as if we were in the Middle Ages, where there wasn't very much mobility, populations were fairly stable, and everybody was just trying to get along. And you may or may not be familiar with the fact, but at least in Europe and in the United Kingdom, often the individual farmers, the freemen, gathered in villages in which there was a large shared open space for grazing the cattle. And that's the idea of the commons. It was a common grazing area. So if you had cattle that you depended on for your food and livelihood, here was a resource that belonged to the whole community. So everybody had a cow or two, so they could all go there and graze and everything was fine. Well, somebody else wanted another cow and they were making it well enough that they got two that could graze there. Why not? It doesn't cost you anything. It's a shared resource. It's an open access resource. So the most economists look on us folks as fairly rational, and we'll do what's best for our own self-interest. So it's in a person's self-interest to have more cows and graze more of them on the commons. You can see where this is going, right? Pretty soon there's no grass left. And it's been pulled up by the roots, and so it doesn't reseed itself, so it's not sustainable, and it's gone. Yeah, a modern version of the tragedy is that we're all acting rationally in our own self-interest. Nobody's being bad. They're just doing what's best for them. That's the way most economic models are built. There's a little altruism, but it doesn't go too far. A modern version of this would be fishing. So every time a boat enters the ocean to go catch fish, it's like another person being added to the population of the earth. It's the same kind of idea. It's a huge resource. It seems unimaginably large, but it is finite. It is finite, and you get enough fishermen on enough boats entering to take advantage of that commons, the ocean, and there are substantial problems about sustainability of a particular resource. I mean, the classic example is the cod fishery off the northeast coast of the United States. I mean, this was a protein source of most of Europe for hundreds of years off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland and Maine in that area. The cod fisheries crashed. You can't make a living fishing for cod anymore. Okay. You can buy some cod here, some northeast cod, if you go to some fancy fishmongers here in the Berkeley area for $18 a pound, something like that. Not many of us are going to do that very often. Besides, there's better fish out there anyway, and they'll be overfished too. So this is not just to be doom and gloom. This is just to say that this is a way of thinking about the issue of K, of what is a sustainability. Now, if you have an open access resource and it's getting overutilized and you can't sustain it, there's some ideas about things you can do. You can privatize it. Everybody can own a little piece, and then they take care of that piece, and that's it. And you need laws to regulate that. You need enforcement, of course, all the stuff that we expect in civil society to take care of that. You can have regulations. So you can have... Does this sound familiar? Does this sound like the political arguments that we have all the time? I mean, I don't know if you guys watch Jon Stewart or something. You know, however you get your news, that's where I get mine. So, this is our life, this stuff. I think there's a third one, and I can't remember it. I have to look at my notes. That's part of a regulatory device, but it's called the polluter pays. It really closely related to those two, but interesting idea that, okay, you can, this is like trading for carbon and carbon emissions. If you pollute with releasing too much CO2, you pay for it, that's all. So if it costs, that tends to reduce the amount of pollution. So I ran when I was thinking about this morning and what I wanted to say about this, I ran across something I thought was just really interesting that I printed out. And if I can find it, I'd like to read it. Oh, here it is, right here. So I remember hearing about this person's work who won the 2009 Nobel Prize in Economics. It's a woman, one of the few women who won it, maybe the only woman who's won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Eleanor Ostrom is her name. And I remembered it because she's at Indiana University, and that's where I was an undergraduate. It's a place much like Berkeley. Very pretty state university. Okay. So she got the 2009 Nobel Prize for Economics for her work on this issue here. And I'll just ramble on a little bit. So she and her colleagues looked at how real-world communities manage communal resources, such as fisheries, land irrigation systems, farmlands, and they identified a number of factors conducive to successful resource management. So this is all stuff you and I could have thought of if we'd been thinking about it. Maybe we can get a Nobel Prize too, I don't know. And I've written this down, so you don't need to take extensive notes because this will be in the notes that I'm posting. So one factor is the things all make sense. One factor is the resource itself. Resources with definable boundaries. For example, land can be preserved much more easily. Of course, you can put a fence around it. All kinds of things. Fishery, that's really tough. Hard to define places. Okay. A second factor is resource dependence. There must be a perceptible threat of resource depletion, and it must be difficult to find substitutes. That seems to me to explain the political landscape in this country, about 90% of it right now. Do you feel threatened by the possibility of global warming? Well, then we have better get our act together. Or, probably not. I don't see it coming. So let's relax. I mean, it's a perception of what's a threat. And is there an alternative? Well, we can do, we don't have to worry about that. We can do such and such. No. The third, and this is the real kicker, is the presence of a community. Small, stable populations with thick social networks and social norms promoting conservation do better. A final condition is that there are appropriate community-based rules and procedures in place with built-in incentives for responsible use and punishment for overuse. Can you see that happening anywhere in the world? Certainly not in this country. I mean, we're such a hodgepodge. I have lived in places that are like that. I even though I was much younger and unaware, largely, of the world, I spent some time in Scandinavia doing scientific research. And, the thought occurred to me, my God, this is a really civilized place. There were no slums. There was nobody who didn't do some kind of work and wasn't proud of their contributions. Even if you're alcoholics all over the place, they've got nothing to do in the winter except drink. So, but everybody was contributing something. But then you think about it, what the population of Sweden is 7 million people? Nothing. And they're all Swedes, They all got the same cultural heritage. They natter at each other. I mean, they have murders and mayhems and all kinds of stuff too, but nothing like on the U.S. scale. We do it bigger and better. So I don't know whether that's encouraging or discouraging to read that kind of that thought through list that she got she got the Nobel Prize for much, much more and a lot of technical stuff. But that was the take-home message for ordinary mortals like you and me. Okay, so I want to talk about water a little bit, and then we're going to go on to food, and that's when we're going to get into Omnivore's Dilemma next time. Because clearly, we've talked about that. Especially for those of us who live out here in the West, as I said before, water is a huge factor in determining sustainability of the environment and how much population growth we can have and the quality of life. Very big deal. Okay, so let's just do a little science. I put this in the notes. The amount of water on the Earth is huge. 1.4 million cubic kilometers of water, but of course most of it's not useful to us because only somewhere between 2 and 5% is actually fresh water, which is what we need for irrigation or for drinking. And of the fresh water that's around, most of that's locked up in glaciers or snow melt or snow. So what we really function on is current precipitation. We don't really have a reservoir of water that's easily accessible and useful. So the equation, these people in this field love equations. The precipitation, that's the PPT, that's been measured. We know about how much precipitation, how much rain, snow, sleet there is per year. And it's they measure this in cubic kilometers, 90 to 120,000. Let's call it 100,000 kilometers a year. And what happens to that is that some of it evaporates right back up into the atmosphere. Some of it goes into plants but then is released by the plants. That's called transpiration. If you put a plant in water or a bulb or something like that, you can see the water level drop day by day by day by day. I mean, those things really use the water. They're not using it all. Most of it, they have little pores in the leaves of every plant called stomata. Stomata is just Latin for mouth. So they're little teeny pores all over the leaves, and they have to open up in order to get the CO2 for the photosynthesis. So when they open up, a little water poofs out. That's transpiration. So there's water loss from evaporation and transpiration. The amount of the same thing, the water goes back up into the atmosphere. So the rest of it is runoff, which we get about 28,000 out of that 100,000 of stuff that's running off, streams, reservoirs, whatever. Some of it goes down into the earth. That's called infiltration. So that's what we've got to work with. That's it. I can think of one additional source of fresh water. How about salt water? Desalination is not present in here because most people consider it way too expensive to remove the salt. But it's happening. Any of you from San Diego area? It's happening down there. Big desalination plants. And as things come online and the technology gets better, it may become competitive cost-wise. Very smart to explore. At any rate, there's a tremendous local variation in how much water we use. So Djibouti and the Arabian Peninsula, the average use per person is 23 cubic meters a year. We use per person about 7,700 cubic meters per year. Amazing. No, actually, we use 9,900. That's the world average, which is heavily influenced by the amount used in developed countries, U.S., Europe, U.K., South America, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, whatever. In Israel, they only use 461 cubic meters per person. A lot of this is due to differences in irrigation practices. In Israel, irrigation is all by drip irrigation. Boop, 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 boop. Where, I don't know, if you travel on 5 down south, it gives me the goosebumps every time I go through the cotton fields coming in before you go over the grapevine. You can see they're just spraying water all over the place. Cotton's a very, very water-intensive crop, and most of that's going for evaporation. It's so hot down there that it's evaporating off where it ever hits the ground. So, huge differences. Anyway, this is, for the moment, this is what we have to work with. So, is there enough water? We can do some calculations. That's kind of fun. You know, I said, how many people are there? There are, let's call it seven. Let's say there's 7 × 10⁹ people, and they're using an average of 7,700 meters cubed per year. So that's 7 × 10⁹ times 7.7 times 10³ is equal to about 50, roughly, times 10⁻¹⁰, or 5 × 10⁻³. Okay? See what I'm doing? Just multiplying people times use. Very simple. Okay, how much water is there? Well, we said there's 100,000 a year. Now, that we're losing a lot of that, but let's get our technology really tuned up. Let's say that we can get most of it. Let's just see what the upper limit is. So that's what's 100,000 cubic kilometers? That's 10⁵. A cubic kilometer is not the same as a cubic meter, huh? Cubic kilometer is 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000, so it's 10⁹ cubic meters. So here's 10⁵, so getting things in the same units, times 10⁹, to convert the kilometers into meters so that these two things can be compared, that's equal to 10⁴. Well, what this tells me is that we're probably already at the limit for water. Unless this 7,700 can be brought down, and we can get more in this range. So probably water is going to be limiting unless we have more conservation, or unless we're willing to pay for more for our water, because then there's these local differences between how much you have, let's say, in the Arabian Peninsula and how much you have in the northeast of the United States. So you can ship water, it just costs. Or it ships, or you can desalinate water, it costs. So all of a sudden, these problems that we think are scientific problems are political problems. How much are people willing to pay for such and such a resource? When I started looking at this stuff, I thought it was simple. You just find out how many people there are and how many resources there are. And I had my own biases. And it's not simple at all. Because all of a sudden, scientific problems in the real world turn into estimating economic costs, what the political will is, what the perception of the problem is. And I'm not talking about party politics now. I'm just talking about human behavior, all of our behaviors, human behavior, how you are in the world. So I don't know what, there isn't any, not easy to say what's right and wrong. So the only conclusion I draw from this is that when somebody says, some politician or public policy person said that they've got the answer and it's this, this, and this, and the other side be damned, you can be sure they probably don't know what they're talking about. They got some other agenda. So, as far as I'm concerned, college education is about getting your bullshit detector way up here. That's actually what life is about. So you can protect yourself from these people who are trying to whatever. Okay, enough of that sermonette there. So this is what we've been talking about. What fraction of water can be recovered? How many calories do we need? Most of the estimates come out to be, I have done a quick kind of survey, and this is the range that maybe the limits on how many people we can support from water is somewhere between 1 and 47. Well, that's not very useful, but most of them turn out to be in the around 15, 20, 25 million, billion, excuse me, something like that. And then here's what we've been talking about. When is the water food available? When and where? What does it cost? And is it going to be sustainable in the long run? Okay, so I think what I want to do now, next, you can kind of see, this is a different kind of science than I'm used to doing, and that maybe you're used to hearing here in this course. This is a lot fuzzier around the edges and much, much harder to get a hold of. But I want to do the same kind of thing, talk a little bit about calories that we need, where's the food coming from, how much does it cost to get there, so on and so forth, and focus on the text in Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, as a way of kind of focusing our attentions on that rather than memorizing what's precisely in the book, but to use that to kind of raise some issues. So one of the first issues that comes up in that book, not the very first, but one of the first things that comes up, is farming and agricultural practices and how much can you get out of the land? What kind of estimates can we make and what kind of stuff are we getting out of the land? So I want to start talking about that next time. And I would appreciate it if you've had a chance to scratch something down on that little survey. If you haven't, maybe you could do it just now on your way out. And there's some boxes back there. Just drop them in there. It would be very useful to me. And I'll see you on Wednesday.